Today's Teisho is entitled, today's Teisho is case 60 from the Pi Yen Lu, the Heikigan Broku, which is the Blue Rock Collection. Case 60 is Umon's staff becoming a dragon. Engo's introduction. Buddhas and sentient beings are not by nature different. Mountains, rivers, and your own self are all just the same. Why should they be separate and constitute two worlds? Even if you are well versed in Zen koans and know how to deal with them, if you stop there, everything is spoiled. If you do not stop, the whole world will be dissolved, with not a particle of it left behind. Now tell me, what does it mean to be well-versed in Zen koans? See the following. Main subject. Umon held out his staff and said to the assembled monks, "The staff has transformed itself into a dragon and swallowed up the whole universe. Where are the mountains, the rivers, and the great world?" Secho's verse. The staff has swallowed up the universe. Don't say peach blossoms float on the waters. The fish that gets its tail singed may fail to grasp the mist and clouds. The ones that lie with gills exposed need not lose heart. My verse is done, but do you really hear me? Only be carefree. Stand unwavering. Why so bewildered? 72 blows are not enough. I want to give you 150. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning and sitting so well, such really excellent sitting. So this is really, koan says that basically if you can answer this koan, you really have trained well in Zen. So it's an important koan to work with, and in a way all the Zen koans are really this koan. So let me read it one more time. Umon, Cloud Gate, held out his staff and he said to the assembled monks, "The staff has transformed itself into a dragon and swallowed up the universe. Where are the mountains, the rivers, and the great world?" So, basically, Umon walks into the Dharma Hall, and he's giving a teisho, and he holds up his staff, and he says, "This staff has transformed into a dragon. When that happens, where are the mountains, the rivers, and the great world?" So let me step away from the koan a minute and talk about some things that might not seem related to it at first, but hopefully I'll get back to the koan. Jaru, when she comes down from New York on Friday nights to sit on Saturday, she stays at our house. And in the car on the way from the train station over here on Friday night, and then at the house, we talk about various things. And one of the things that Jaru talked about was her department chair. If you're in an academic unit, probably at some point in your life you will have a department chair who causes problems for you. Just like if you have a job in the corporate world, it's very likely at some point you'll have a boss who makes you uncomfortable or worse. So in a way, the department chair isn't quite the boss, but is like a boss, okay? And the department chair can create a lot of difficulties for people, and Jaru's department chair has created huge amounts of tension and friction in the department. She is very, very determined to realize her vision of how the department should be. And she has all of these ideas. You know, they're going to expand into this, and they're going to expand into that, and they're going to do this, and they're going to do that. And the people in her department are mostly tenured professors, and they have their own interests, right? I mean, they do their research, they do their teaching, and basically they just want to be left alone to do their research and their teaching, because that's their job. And the department chair has all of these new ideas about how things can be done. And people don't necessarily want to follow her lead. They don't see the point. They don't agree about the goals, and so on. And she's gets very angry at people. And she retaliates against them if they don't cooperate with her. And Jaro said that a number of her secretaries have actually taken retirement because it's so difficult to work with her. She's kind of a toxic personality, you know. And it's funny, you know, this same thing happened to me, something similar, happened to me this week. There is a person in my department who is also a toxic personality. And she behaves very much like Jaro's department chair. And in fact, a number of people in our department filed a grievance against this person, who I will not name, for her retaliating against them, yelling at them, abusing them. And I had to go to testify. There's like a legal proceeding. Apparently a number of people in my department got together and filed a formal grievance against this person, and now there's actually a lawyer who collects all the testimonies. And on Tuesday morning, I had to go down into New Brunswick. Rutgers has some offices in New Brunswick, near the State Theater, and it's right next to the Dunkin' Donuts. In fact, I walked past the place 5 times, and then I realized, this is behind the Dunkin' Donuts. There's a door, basically, that leads into all these offices. So I finally found the place, and then I had to testify, and I had to testify for an hour. And it was all about, have you seen this person yelling at people? And I said, yes, I have. She had access to people's private emails, and she was reading their emails, and if they criticized her, she was retaliating. It's like there were violations of privacy. There are all these problems. And I actually know this person, you know. And she is let me just put it this way. Her outward-facing personality is terrifying to people, right? She uses her power to intimidate her subordinates. Apparently has retaliated against people to the point of like yelling at them and threatening their jobs. So, you know, I wasn't really aware of much of this until these complaints came to the surface, because I don't see this person doesn't yell at me. This person is a subordinate to me and doesn't treat me like that. Apparently she treats all her people who she reports to up the ladder as she's very nice, very sweet. But if you're down the ladder from her, she's dropping heavy rocks on you and threatening you if you complain. So, you know, when I heard all the complaints and I began to realize, you know, this picture emerged of this person who's kind of like a monster, right? A monster. You know, she yells at people, she screams, she threatens them, she threatens their jobs, and she actually probably could get people fired. She has a lot of authority. And she eavesdrops on their emails. She's had access to some people's private emails, and she's done all kinds of terrible things. So that is her outward-facing personality. And when I went through this week, I mean, I was really kind of stunned. And one of the other people in my office who works with me, when he heard about this too, he had to go testify. And he hadn't seen any of this. It's like when she's around us, she's so pleasant and nice. It's like last night I had my cat, Henry, on my lap. And Henry looked at me with the sweetest eyes, right? And he was so beautiful and wonderful. And you know, if I were a little bird in my backyard, Henry's face would be the last terrible thing I see in the world, right? So to a bird, Henry's face is the face of death, right? And I looked at him last night, and he's sitting on my lap, and it's like, oh, this little cat wouldn't hurt a flea, right? Well, I think she's like that in my office, right? When she's around us, it's like, what a lovely person, right? And she goes out and beats people up, basically. And this, when I was sitting this morning, this resonated. What Jara was saying about her department chair is very much like this person in my office. Now, you know, I don't know Jara's department chair, but I've seen this person in my office. And I can tell you there's another side to her which doesn't excuse that other, her public actions. But she is deeply unhappy and insecure. And, you know, I've seen her go up for promotions and not get them. And she's come into my office and just sobbed, like, multiple days, really. Like, days. You know, she in particular wanted a position in our department as like a business manager. And she had no qualifications, but she was working so hard to sell everybody on her qualifications. She was doing reports, business reports, you know, budget reports like crazy. But they were kind of, you know, they weren't exactly professional budget reports. And she didn't get the job, and she was crushed. She had no chance to get that job. She had no qualifications for that. And when she didn't get it, she took a day off, and she sobbed in my office. We've gone through this many times. So, you know, this is a person who her parents got divorced. Her father left her very early in her life. Basically, she feels abandoned by her father, who's a professor in Arizona. Her mother is a psychoanalyst, and I think her mother is very, in some ways, disapproving of the life choices she's made. So, you know, I see like two sides of this person, and the one side, or I'm now seeing two sides of this person. I've only seen one side, which is the unhappy, sort of self-punishing person. And now I've seen the other side, which is the angry, domineering, and even threatening person, you know, that others see. And these are, you know, these are two sides of the same coin. You know, she's deeply unhappy with who she is, and it doesn't excuse her behavior, but it's interesting to see both sides, right? And I think this is fairly common, right? I mean, when this person, this administrative assistant, behaves in these terrible ways, she's driven by a sense of desperation, right? Desperation. You know, if she doesn't realize her plan, she's unworthy, or she's nothing, right? She's a failure. You know, so I think she's haunted by a sense of personal unworthiness, and that if she doesn't do these things, she's a failure. And I have the feeling Jaru's department chair is like this too. You know, she screams, you know, where does that come from, right? Where you ask somebody to do something and they criticize you, and then you just start screaming at them. Where does that come from? And I've seen this before. I had a person who was an assistant director in my program, and she was responsible for mentoring like 8 new teachers in my program who were all graduate students. And one day she called me up and she said, "Kurt, these graduate students are not coming to my mentoring sessions. And they're supposed to come to 5, 1 every 3 weeks during the semester." And she said, "You've got to, you know, they're not coming. They're violating their agreement." So, you know, I was thinking, what's wrong with these graduate students? You know, I'm going to have to give them a talking to. And then I started meeting with them, and my assistant was, you know, like terrorizing them, basically. Was very rigid, very demanding, very critical. And the graduate students I talked to, one guy said, "You can fire me, but I'm never going back into that person's room again." So, I realized it was her. She was the problem, right? She was so afraid not to do a good job. She was so afraid of being a failure that she was driving everybody crazy. So anyway, I remember calling her up on the phone, and I was talking to her about, you know, trying to lead her, trying to get to the point where I said, "Look, the problem is you," right? And I was trying to do this in a way that was gentle and affirming, right? And when I said, I told her the truth. I said, people are so unhappy with your group that they are, they would rather be fired than work for you, right? She started sobbing, right? Just sobbing. It was like, you know, you've heard of somebody having broken-hearted sobbing, right? It was like that. And I felt terrible. It was like, oh. But, you know, she wanted to do a good job, and she was so afraid of not doing a good job that she was driving people crazy. She was threatening behavior or domineering behavior, very rigid behavior. And this is fairly common in the world, right? People trying to get power over others and force them to do something or frightening them and so on. And you think, where does that come from? And I do think behind that terrible, you know, face of destruction, there's this person who's just running scared, right? So, as I said, the fact that these people are scared doesn't excuse their abusive behavior to others, but it definitely is worth looking at. You know, how does this happen? You know, I was reading something the other day about, I'm writing something about Buddhism, and I was reading something about early Buddhism and how, you know, people in the modern world think of Buddhism as something that is largely based in remote mountain enclaves, right? So, you know, if you Google Buddhism Korea, you'll see all of these beautiful little temples up in the mountains. Or if you Google Buddhism Japan, you know, you'll see all of these beautiful temples, right, that seem very remote. But actually, you know, Buddhism has always been, Buddhism got its start actually in India when cities began to emerge. You know, Buddhism wasn't really a primitive religion, you know, of tribal people. Buddhism got started when India was transitioning from villages to cities, actually. And so Indian people around the Buddhist time were becoming like almost like modern people. They were leaving their villages, they were coming to cities. And, you know, it was interesting because people went through a real transformation, you know. If you were in a village in India, just like if you were in a village in Great Britain, you know, if you were in a village in Great Britain 400 years ago, if your name was Potter, you made pots, you know. And if your name was Smith, you made horseshoes, basically, and iron objects. And if your name was Wheelwright, you made wheels, and so on. You know, there was a time when you were your, like, identity, right? You were your social role. And you know, when people began to leave the villages and go into cities, there was a chance for them to be something other than their social role, you know? So, you know, if you are interested in, a friend of mine just did Ancestry.com, and she was, one of the things they do is they go back in history and tell you what occupations your ancestors had, right? And it turns out most of her ancestors were like peasants, right? You know. And she was very disappointed. She was hoping there was some British royalty in there somewhere. It didn't turn out to be the case, right? You know, but basically, you know, if you were a miller, you milled grain. You know, that was who you were. When you come to the city, you know, you don't have to be a miller anymore. You don't have to be a potter. You might keep the name, but, you know, actually, I have a friend named Miller, and he's not a miller. You know, he's an English professor, right? You know, you meet people named Pot. Harry Potter didn't make pots, right? He was a wizard. So, you know, this comes from this wonderful development where people can step out of their social roles, their social identities, and be something new or be something different. And this is real liberation. This is, you know, you leave the past and you can become something new. This is liberation. You know, society won't tell you who you are. You can decide for yourself who you are. See? You know, actually, if you think about it, in the Buddhist time, this was happening a lot. People were leaving the villages and coming to the city, and they were reinventing themselves. And, you know, if you think about it, the Buddha reinvented himself, actually. You know, the Buddha was the son of a chieftain. And his father said, you're going to be the next chieftain. And the Buddha said, you know what? I'm not going to do that. I'm going to reinvent myself, see? So, you know, even the Buddha is like leaving that identity behind and becoming something new. So anyway, you know, this is, I think, a great gain. When in our time, this sort of like change is still going on. Like when I was a young man, there were books written by women who said, you know, there's more to me than my identity as a mother and a wife. And by the way, that created a firestorm. People were absolutely furious and terrified that women were saying, you know, I'm not just a mother and a wife. I can be a professor. I can be a scientist, you know. This was deeply threatening to a lot of people. And it's still deeply threatening to a lot of people. But what women were saying is, you know, my society has assigned me a role as wife and mother, But I don't have to accept society's role, right? I don't have to accept that. I can be something else. I can create myself, see? And this was, I think, this is like liberation. In our time, you know, you have a lot of young people who say, you know, I was born male. On my birth certificate, it says male. But, you know, I don't want to be a male. And then, you know, at one time people say, well, then you want to be a female. And some people say, yes, I'm biologically male, but I want to live my life as a woman. And now there are people who say, well, you know, I don't want to be a male and I don't want to be a woman. You know, I'm gender fluid. Now, my personal feeling is that this is absolutely fantastic and totally consistent with the social movement that began with Buddha 2,500 years ago. Because the Buddha said, you have no essential self. You have no essential self. See? And liberation is seeing that. Seeing that, you know, somebody told you you were a man, somebody told you you were a woman, but you don't have to be those things. And if somebody says, oh yes, you do, you have breasts, you know, that's really not a determining factor according to the Buddha. So you know, there's a tremendous potential for people to be free from these social roles, which are often quite stupid and punishing, right? And so, if you look at what's happening in our culture, you know, there's this tremendous sort of like agitation for people. We're sort of discovering, whether we practice the Dharma or not, that our essential self is not given to us at birth, you know. And you have these people who are, you know, they don't want to be male, they don't want to be female. You have women who say, I wasn't put on this earth to be a mother and a wife. I don't want to get married. I don't want to have children. Or if I have children, that doesn't mean I can't be a microbiologist, right? And this is, as I say, tremendous explosion of, I think, of freedom. And actually, like, truth-telling. Because we know from the Buddhist teaching that people have no essential self. You know, so part of Zen practice is discovering that. You know, so most of us do think we have a self. We have an essential self. And it's not really our self. It's the identities that have been imposed on us by people as we're growing up. You know? And what we've done is we've embraced or internalized those identities as though they were who we really were, if this makes any sense. You know? So, my friend John Sunston, I've talked about this a lot, you know, he grew up in a family that was a very artistic family. His father was a pianist of Finnish. His father was from Finland, and his family came to this country around the time of the turn of the century, the turn of the previous century. End of the 19th century and 20th century. And his father had spent some time in the United States and had actually been born in Finland. And he was an old European sort of aristocratic character. When I would go over to his house, it was the middle of the day and he was sitting in the house in a full suit, right? So, you know, he didn't wear his pajamas all day, he wore a suit. And he did have music students coming, but you could say he was never unbuttoned, right? He was always sort of like the great musician. Even at home, he'd be in his suit with a vest and so on. And his mother was like an actress. And his sister, John Sunston's sister, had a career on Broadway. And she was quite a respected actress on Broadway, and she married a guy named Burgess Meredith. If you're old enough, you'll know who Burgess Meredith is. He was another Broadway star and a terrible human being, and they got divorced. But you know, John came from this super artistic family, and, you know, he had piano lessons when he was very young, and his sister was taking drama lessons and went to Broadway. And, you know, John was like the odd man out because he wanted to study the sciences. And his parents, it was like, my mother all the time was telling me, if only you became a doctor, you could write, you know, because I was good in the sciences. And she'd say, Kurt, you've got to become a doctor. You can write your own ticket. Now, I didn't know what that meant, but it sounded good. And I would get her these A's, and she'd say, you know, you've got to become a doctor. You got an A in calculus. You got an A in chemistry. And I'd say, Mother, you know, I think I'm going to major in English. And she would just, you know, she said, Kurt, you know what? You're throwing your life away. Right? And how right she was, you know, in a certain way. But you know, John had the opposite. He was like, what? A scientist? What's wrong with you? Right? And his parents were really unhappy with him. They even, in one year, they even, their unhappiness with him produced a reaction formation where he began to act out. And he got in trouble, you know. And they sent him to a military academy for a couple of years to straighten him out. So very traumatizing for him. But he eventually came back from the military academy and went to college, and he became a doctor, you know, much to his parents' shame, right? And became a brain scientist at the University of Washington, and he started studying Zen, and that's how I met him. But, you know, all his life he's kind of had this inferiority complex because all these people in his family are like these talented artists. See, you know, I think that happens to all of us, right? People expect things of us. And we internalize, sometimes we resist the role, right? We resist. And sometimes we try to live up to it, right? You know, when we do this, we're trading away our freedom, right? It's difficult not to do that sometimes, right? Because you know, people want to please other people, right? I mean, John wanted to please his parents. He wanted them to say, "John, we love you. We're so proud of you." But on the other hand, his interests were in a completely different direction. And so he had to, you know, find a way to deal with their disapproval. And I think, you know, he's about 85 now, so it doesn't matter. His parents are long gone, but I think a lot of his life he lived in the shadow of their disapproval. And he coped with this by doing Zen. And I think one of the reasons Zen was liberating for him was that he would sit down on a cushion and enter deep samadhi, and he would enter mushin, what we call mushin, emptiness. You know, it's like we Zen people know that when you start peeling back the layers of the mind, you know, you peel this layer, you peel this layer, you peel this layer, you peel this layer. You know, at this core of the mind, there seems to be nothing there. You know, there seems to be nothing there. And the Buddha himself often compared the mind, he compared it to a banana stalk or a stalk of bamboo, right? So if you know anything about banana plants, you take away all the leaves, there's nothing left. A banana plant just is a bunch of giant leaves coming out of the ground, and if you try to get to the core of the banana plant, there isn't one. And the same thing is true with a piece of bamboo. If you cut it open, it's hollow. So the Buddha often used that as a metaphor for us. for the mind. And, you know, when you sit down on the cushion and you do meditation a lot, you begin to reach this place in the mind that is blank and empty. And I think my friend John found that extremely liberating, right? It's like this place where he sees that he doesn't fundamentally deserve his parents' disapproval, right? Inside himself, there's this spacious empty, what seems to be this bright or dark spacious emptiness that's free from that disapproval, see? And this is not enlightenment, but it's definitely the beginning of enlightenment. When people realize that deep inside themselves there's this hollow core, right? You know, for some people that's terrifying. The idea that you're empty in yourself might sound terrifying. But actually, you know, if you practice meditation and you get to that empty place, you realize that it's so liberating to be there. You know, fundamentally, when you're in that emptiness, you don't feel bereft or impoverished or isolated. You feel, you know, when you open your eyes and you walk outside, you feel connected to everything. See, and now you've been liberated from all of those expectations. You know, the fact that you failed calculus doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You know, the fact that you didn't become a doctor doesn't matter. You get to that place and this is, you realize, you know, the human being is not any of these roles, any of these identities that have been imposed on us, you know. You know, those identities are ephemeral, and many people have jobs now, they say that in 100 years won't even exist, right? You know, it's very important, I think, in many ways for us not to identify too closely with our social roles. I think that my administrative assistant, the administrative assistant in my department, who is such a tyrant and who is driven by such desperation, is terrified of not. She's terrified that her father and mother's disapproval of her will be justified. And I think she would kill to escape their disapproval, almost, right? Sometimes people do commit murder because of something like that, really. But she would definitely hurt other people and cause them suffering in order to escape from the disapproval of her parents. And she'll never come to sit, and I don't proselytize people who work for me and tell them to try Zen. But it's definitely the case that if she could find this place in herself, she could forgive herself. And not just forgive herself, she could have real joy in her life, knowing that none of these things are real. And until people can separate from their identities, you know, they're always enslaved, in my opinion, if I may say so. You know, there's always going to be this kind of desperation. When we separated ourself from our identity, we created a space, you know, as human beings. I don't have to be a potter anymore. I don't have to be a wheelwright. I don't have to be a miller. I can be something new. But in the modern world, you know, we don't have somebody telling us, you have to be the best you're born to be an administrative assistant. But when we internalize that role, and we treat it like it's who we really are, we're in for a world of suffering. You know, so I think a better way to live is to live from that empty place, you know? To live in that emptiness and then treat your roles as roles, right? Like you're an actor on a stage, right? So, you know, if I have to teach a class and I say to myself, I have to be the most brilliant teacher in the world or I'm a total failure, I am going to have a miserable semester, right? Because you know what? I'm going to have my off days, right? I'm going to come in, I'm going to have a wonderful lecture, and my students are going to be staring at the ceiling. And they're going to be thinking of lunch or sex or something other than what I'm teaching, right? And I'm going to tell jokes and they're not going to laugh, and you know, so on. You know, I'll never forget when I was in graduate school, I brought in this essay by a writer named D.H. Lawrence. And he lived in New Mexico for a while, and I had been to New Mexico, and I love New Mexico. And this essay is lyrical, beautiful. You know, I'd read this essay like 20 times, and I thought, oh, this is going to be a hit. And I brought it into my, I assigned my students to read it, and they came into class, and I was thinking, this is going to be one hell of a great class. And they didn't even like it. They didn't get it. And I was so furious, right? I mean, I didn't curse them out or something, or throw things at them. But I lost my cool, you know? I was so invested in getting them to like this text, and when they didn't like it, I felt like a total failure, right? So, you know, I got too close. I internalized my role too much, you know? I was, everything I was on the line at that moment. And that's a terrible feeling. And I was mad at them. You know, that turns into hostility, right? It turns into anger. And, you know, I did learn from that, you know. You just have to realize, you know, they might not like this. This might not be the best. I'm an English teacher, but it's not who I am. See, that's my role. That's my role. I play an English teacher. You know the old joke. I'm not, you know, I'm not really a doctor, but I play one on TV. I think that's a good mentality for doctors. They should say, "I'm not really a doctor, but I play one in the hospital." See, and I think that's psychologically much better for them. Because I think. You know, if you say the doctor is who I am, that's my essential being. See, that's a kind of slavery, really. It's a kind of oppression. You're punishing yourself. Because look, there's so many things about a doctor's life you can't control. You know, my previous doctor passed away from cancer, Dr. Gandotra, and he was a wonderful doctor. And he told me, sat down one day when I went to see him when he was still alive, and he said, "You're an English professor, aren't you, Kurt?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "That must be a good life." And I said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Because my mother always told me I should be a doctor." And he said, "Do you know how many headaches I have being a doctor?" He said, "I'm an internist, internal medicine." And he said, "You know, basically, I get like $100 a patient, basically. And I have to pay for my, receptionist. I have to have a bookkeeper because everybody has a different insurance." And he went through all this stuff. And it was just, I never thought about it. You know, I never thought that he had all these stresses, right? And he could, you know, I'm sure when he went to medical school, he was thinking he was going to be this doctor who comes in and helps people. And he was a fantastic doctor. But there's so many things he couldn't control in his life about being a doctor. You know? And I think it ate away at him. You know, I think it bothered him. You know, he needed to get free from his doctor role. I'm not saying he should have just gone in and done a lousy job. But I'm saying you need to create a distance between yourself. Your role should not be yourself. You have no self. See, so when you go in to teach English, you are pretending to be an English teacher. You're going to give it your best shot. but it's not who you really are. And I think that's the Buddha's way, personally. Feel free to disagree. But, you know, that's what having an empty self is all about. We don't have an empty self so we can embrace the roles that society gives us. We have an empty self so we don't get captured by those roles. You know, even being a parent, you know, or being a husband or a wife, you know, we just had our 43rd anniversary. And, you know, when my wife and I got married, I wanted to be the best possible husband I could be. And I read all these books like Eric Fromm's Art of Loving and all this stuff. And it drove me, after a while, I felt like I needed to get divorced, really. It was so oppressive, right? And my wife, it was like we had a conversation. You feel the same way, you know? And we just realized we're not going to play this game anymore. You know, we're not going to play this game. It's too oppressive, right? We're just going to go with the flow, you know? We'll try to work it out. We're going to throw Eric Fromm in the trash. And we're just going to invent our relationship. We're not going to worry about what it's supposed to look like, you know? And actually, that's worked out pretty well. You know, so, you know, basically, my wife doesn't cook, you know, and I cook, you know, and things like that. That's trivial, but there's lots of ways in which we've decided not to be like the couple we grew up thinking we had to be. And it's probably the reason why we stayed together, because that model is so oppressive, right? I think it's very important for us, of course, to do Zazen. And I think Zazen is liberating in every possible way, and I think the more people do, the better. And one of the things you discover when you do Zazen is the emptiness of yourself, but we forget, right? It's why you have to, you know, even the Dalai Lama meditates every day. Even the Buddha meditated. We know, you know, from the early sutras how the Buddha spent his day. He didn't get much sleep. You know, he's supposed to only get like a couple hours of sleep a night. You know, but he would get up in the morning and meditate, and then he'd be meeting with people all day, doing like Dokusan all day. He'd go out begging and get something to eat, get lunch, and then come back and he'd be meeting with like the king, you know, literally. And then he'd meditate into the wee hours of the evening. He'd get a couple hours of sleep, and the next day was the same thing. But even the Buddha was just pretending to be the Buddha. You know, he knew that there is no self at the center of who we are. And this is far from being a disaster. It's freedom, and it's the spaciousness of who we really are, the openness to possibility. See, none of these social roles are real, and if we internalize them and we treat them as who we really are, it's a life of misery, I believe. You know, I've told this story before, but in an English department, the more books you publish, the more people respect you. So if you publish one book, you're an associate professor. If you publish two books, you're a professor. If you publish three books, you're a distinguished professor. If you publish five books, you know, you're a superstar, right? But you know what? Somebody's always published more books than you have. Even if you've published five, there's somebody who's published six. So, you know, you can always be miserable if you haven't, but somebody's published 100, right? But then nobody reads those, right? So then that person's miserable. That is a game we play with ourselves that makes us miserable. Miserable. None of these roles are real. You know, the library is full of books by people who wrote 30 books, and everybody said they were a genius, and now nobody reads those books and nobody knows their name. It was all pretend. It was all a game. So, you know, to live the Zen life is to go back over and over again to that freedom inside of ourselves and live from that freedom. And of course, when I teach English or when I grade papers, I try to be the very best professor I can be. If you're a doctor, be the best doctor you can be, but don't lose that space. Don't lose that emptiness. It's just a role. You're just on a stage playing a role. Play the role, but then live in that emptiness. One more thing. You know, there's a guy who used to sit here who is a doctor. He's not here today, but he had been sitting with us for a long time. He was coming at least once a week, and then he told me, listen, I'm not going to be sitting with you anymore because I've been promoted to the head of this division that the emergency medicine division. And I haven't seen him for like a couple of years, I think, or a year at least, maybe 2 years, something like that. And he came to sit the other night. And I said, it's great to see you. What are you doing here? And he said, I quit. He said, it became so oppressive for me. You know, it became so oppressive. I'm going to take care of what really matters. You know, I'm sure he's going to have a medical practice of some kind, but he didn't want to be the division chief anymore. Now, you know, my feeling is, I don't know that job, but he might have been able to be the division chief and preserve that emptiness, right? If he might have been able to do that, but that takes a lot of zazen. That takes a lot of practice. But I think he made the right decision. He realized he had gotten captured. You know, I'm sure his mother, if she's still alive, when she learned he was going to be division chief, was thrilled, right? My son, the division chief. But on the other hand, you know, I think that internalizing those roles, internalizing those identities is slavery. And it's a formula for misery, right? You can be in the world but free if you can cultivate that emptiness, if you make that emptiness the center of your life. Umon's staff becomes a dragon. Engo's introduction. Buddhas and sentient beings are not by nature different. Mountains, rivers, and your own self are all just the same. Why should they be separate and constitute two worlds? Even if you are well-versed in Zen koans and know how to deal with them, if you stop there, everything is spoiled. If you do not stop, the whole world will be dissolved, with not a particle of it left behind. Now tell me, what does it mean to be well-versed in Zen koans? See the following. Master Umon held out his staff and said to the assembled monks, "This staff has transformed itself into a dragon and swallowed up the whole universe." That's what happens to us when we return to emptiness. See? When we return to emptiness, we transform ourselves, or we're open to transformation. And to be alive is to play this role and this role and this role, but never be captured by any of them. It's to be like a dragon, right? The dragon lives in the high heavens and he goes down to the depths of the sea. You know, and he plays in the clouds and he frolics in the waves. Every place at home, because here's no essential self. The staff has transformed itself into a dragon and swallowed up the universe. Where are the mountains, the rivers, and the great world? Setra's verse, the staff has swallowed up the universe. Don't say peach blossoms float on the waters. The fish gets its tail singed. The fish that gets its tail singed may fail to grasp the mist and clouds. Don't get trapped. Don't get trapped in your identities. Don't be like a fish on the dock, its gills pumping the air futilely, right? The ones that lie with gills exposed. No need to lose heart. My verse is done, but do you really hear me? Only be carefree, be empty, stand unwavering. Why so bewildered? 72 blows are not enough. I want to give you 150.